It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. By the end of last year, some of the wealthiest hospitals in the U.S. came out with healthy bottom lines, in part thanks to federal relief funds. UPMC here in Pittsburgh is one of them. Reporter Christine Spolar co-authored the story with Jordan Rao. It's been published by Kaiser Health News and The Washington Post. Christine, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
I understand that your initial interest in this story was because UPMC was sending out fundraising pleas to support healthcare heroes when its revenue was actually doing pretty well. What did executives at UPMC tell you?
Well, the reason we were interested in the story is that UPMC, like others, were coming out with financial statements showing, you know, very healthy bottom lines, even with the pandemic. And much of it was because they were getting money, the federal bailout money.
Mm-hmm. Can you remind us about how much money was allocated through the CARES Act to hospitals and healthcare providers? And was it outright grants, loans?
No, these are outright grants, though they have to be evaluated as the money goes out. And they were specifically at the beginning to offset costs of treating infected patients, purchasing ventilators, masks, gowns. Later on, Congress authorized the hospitals to use the money to compensate for the drop in revenue from elective surgeries, which was a very big issue. And, you know, hospitals needed that money. They, all of them that we wrote about in May were in a lot of trouble. And as they learned how to deal with the pandemic and also to safeguard their own facilities as well as their staff, they were able to figure out how to get people into the facilities. And that's where you saw elective surgeries rebounding and also their bottom lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, UPMC has an insurance arm, which is part of why it did so well. Did other hospitals that you analyzed also have insurance arms or maybe some extra revenue streams that help keep them afloat?
Yes, I had talked to officials there and some of the authorities there and saying that we always knew that insurance arm made us more diverse and would be protective if there was ever kind of an emergency like a pandemic, though nobody ever expected a pandemic. Other hospitals that have similar insurance arms, they were more protected.
Mm-hmm. You reported that wealthier hospitals and systems were better off by the end of last year than poorer hospitals because the wealthier ones got more federal relief. Why did they get more money?
The Department of Health and Human Services based the first allotments of the bailout funds on hospitals' past revenue. So that, by its nature, favored institutions with, you know, patients who had private health plans. And the distribution formula did not take into account the assets, which hospitals already had enough assets to survive. And the question has been raised, if they were doing well by the end of the year, why weren't they turning back some of the money?
When do hospitals have to return any the unspent pandemic relief money? And do you expect a lot will be returned?
I don't know what to expect with that, actually. But hospitals can hold on to the unspent relief funds until the end of July. And that's because there could be future pandemic related costs. And when I talked to Ed Karlovich here for the UPMC, he said, we're still in the process of incurring costs related to COVID. So you saw people learning about the disease in real time and trying to adapt. Meanwhile, they were spending money in order just to make certain they had what they could to address it.
So when you spoke to UPMC, did they still have unspent relief funds and did they expect to use them up or return them?
Oh, I know that they were not going to return them at that point. Now, this was in February and March when I talked to people. You know, they may be rethinking. Now, I tend not to think so because when I look at the statistics for Allegheny County and Pennsylvania, there were concerns. So I tend to think that they are not going to adjust their thinking on that.
Christine, what other questions might you have regarding this whole story? We'll have to wait and see if hospitalizations jump again or what?
Well, I think this is a really interesting time in health systems and how they think about their communities and what they are learning from the pandemic. In some sense, the pandemic was an accelerant for telemedicine and for other kinds of innovations that, you know, health systems had thought about but had not really pushed. UPMC has said that their insurance arm, having an insurance arm, made them already realize what the needs of the community were because they could see what people were coming in for, and there is a, you know, there is a constant flow of information. So, you know, will other hospitals look at that model?
Reporter Christine Spoller co-authored a story with Jordan Rao that many wealthy hospitals in the U.S. had healthy surpluses during the pandemic, thanks in part to federal funds. We'll have a link to her report on our website, WESA.FM. Christine, thanks so much for your reporting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Is it a snake? A robot? A submarine? Maybe a little of all three. A team from Carnegie Mellon University's Robotics Institute has been testing a snake bot that can swim underwater for inspection work and fit into tight spaces. Holly Chosett is a professor of robotics and is the co-director of the Biorobotics Lab at Carnegie Mellon University. Holly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Howie, we did a story a few years back about the snake bot. So is this a whole new model, or did you teach it some new tricks?
This is new in that the components to make the robot work underwater are definitely new. Our snake robots are made up of modules. We link them together to form a snake. What we've done is we've built new underwater modules that leverage, use all of our prior knowledge of making snakes work on land, but give it the added capability of working underwater.
What else can this snake bot do, or is this specifically designed only for underwater? Because you have other snake bots.
Yeah, we have a lot of different kinds of snake robots, and the ones we're very famous for, the ones that crawl on the ground and climb up pipes. In fact, they climb up people's legs sometimes. This robot goes underwater, and what makes driving these robots underwater especially challenging is that when you're on land, if you tell the robot, go to the right, the robot aims to the right and goes. When you're underwater, if you ask the robot, go to the right, well, the front will go to the right, but the back will go to the left. And in fact, it's not just left and right, it's up, down, and rotating around in all sorts of different ways.
Now, these snake robots have been used, well, for instance, following the earthquake in Mexico City in 2017, right?
That's right. These robots, they're called snake robots because they look like metallic snakes. And what's nice about them is that they have a small cross-sectional diameter that allows them to thread through tightly packed volumes and get to places that people and machinery otherwise can't access very easily. So they serve as a nice tool to extend the reach of rescue workers.
Of course, like a snake slithers and is able to bend its body this way and that way. You have multiple joints on your robotic snake so it can shift directions?
Yes, the snake robot has many joints. The ones that we had in Mexico City actually have 16 joints. We call them degrees of freedom, but essentially it's like your elbow. It's having lots of little elbows stacked alongside each other.
This snake robot, I understand, was developed in part to assist the Department of Defense. So what would its role be?
One of the envisioned applications for the underwater snake robot is to do inspection on naval ships as they're coming into port. Right now, damage assessment is done by a Navy diver who goes underwater with a flashlight, poking around, and a rope that'll help him get back out. And that's it. What we want to do is provide automation that will not only make the process safer, because now the diver doesn't have to get into tight spaces, but it's also going to speed up the process quite a bit. There's no longer having to fly the person in, the person has to suit up, has to go underwater, etc. In fact, what we believe is going to happen is not only will we get better inspections, because now the robot's doing the inspections of the diver, the other thing is now that we are able to look at the damage or the possible damage with a robot vision sensor, we can record the images so we can maintain a health state, of the ship. And in fact, by saving these images and processing them over time, we may be able to detect problems that otherwise would have been unperceived.
Are there other potential applications?
Yeah, another application actually still is search and rescue. In some of the disasters, there's flooding, and it's important, again, to locate people as quickly as possible, or unfortunately sometimes recover victims as quickly as possible. And in some of the disasters like the floods that we had in the United States, as well as the tidal wave in Fukushima, there was a lot of underwater rescue that had to happen.
What kind of technical challenges do you run into when you go from a land snake robot to water, aside from the obvious, I guess, waterproofing of the robot?
When we go from the land robot to the underwater robot, there's a lot of software, there's a lot of controls that has to be adapted. So for example, if we ask the robot to, say, slither like a snake, you know, move forward like a snake does on the ground, the robot just pushes off the ground and off it goes. Underwater, there's nothing to push off of. To make it even more challenging, and I should say more interesting too, is you're now really moving in three dimensions. And then finally, it's rare that the current is standing still. You know, there is a current that we're going to have to counteract as we're moving through the space.
What is your next goal for your snake robots?
We want to be able to build better modular systems so we can have other shapes other than snakes. And maybe one day we can have our modular systems sort of disassemble and reassemble on the fly, you know, just like the Terminator 2 robot did, but a friendly version of it, of course.
Holly Chosen is a professor of robotics and is the co-director of the Biorobotics Lab at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The arts, theater, dance, and music are still trying to find their footing as the pandemic continues for a second year. Quantum Theater in Pittsburgh is taking a foray into a new kind of performance. A self-guided experience takes you through downtown and Frick Park. At each stop, participants will pop on headphones and listen to a story. The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams spoke with the director of 10 for 21, John Shepherd.
How do you describe this performance?
Maybe if I go back to the inspiration for me, Giovanni Boccaccio's Decameron, which are 100 stories that he wrote in 1348 during the Black Plague of Florence. Since we're in another pandemic, I thought, let me go back to that source and see what that's about. And they're very famous stories. There are, you know, the whole premise of the thing is that 10 young people, 7 women, 3 men, leave Florence during the plague and set off and go to country estates. And every day for 10 days, they each one of them tells a story. So there's 10 stories per day for 10 days, and hence the Decameron. And they're not at all about, you know, living through a plague or any of that kind of stuff. They are kind of escapist stories. They're very body stories. It's one of the first sort of risque, you know, books in print. And we picked 10 stories out of the Decameron, and he adapted them. And then Carla, you know, had the idea of you know, sort of making it an immersive experience, walking around, listening to the stories. We decided to do what we're calling an urban experience and a rural experience. So hence downtown for the urban experience and Frick Park for the rural experience. We thought, you know, it's basically telling stories that people can listen to while they're, you know, having an experience in these locations. And people did not have to necessarily go to Frick Park or downtown to experience these stories, that they could listen to them from the comfort of their, you know, backyard, their living room.
The idea behind this work, which you talked about earlier, is the Decameron. And it's these stories that this group of friends tell each other while they are escaping, or while they have fled Florence because of the plague.
Right.
At the heart of this work, the idea is a pod of friends who take pandemic walks together, which feels very accurate. Was it always kind of a choice to make it walking?
our idea is that we've got, you know, 10 sort of theater students, a pod, and they're sort of stuck to sort of pass the time. They go for these walks and tell each other these stories. So we are keeping the names of the characters from the original Decameron. Each character's got their own sort of eccentricities or, you know, unique qualities. But we're not really getting, we don't find out too much about these characters. The important thing are the stories that they're telling.
These are like very fantastical stories.
Yeah, they. I think that Boccaccio wrote this in many ways to take the reader away from the troubles that they're living through, and they are more or less escapist, fantastical, if you will. But they're also sardonic. There's a lot of satire. There's a lot of bawdiness and a lot of sexiness. We don't recommend the stories for young people.
So how long will 10 for 21 be available?
As long as it's on the Quantum website, and that's how you sort of access it. You go to their website and option or the rural option, and then you just sort of download the stories that way. So I guess as long as it's on their website, and I have no idea how long that's going to be, probably for a while, I would think maybe at least a couple, 2-3 months.
Do you think that this decision to pursue something so immersive and kind of interactive, but also kind of letting go of control as a director, was a creative stretch for you?
Oh, absolutely. I've never directed film. I mean, I've acted in film and on television, and in a weird way, I my analogy for this experience has been kind of like it's like directing 10 short films. And I think it's kind of cool that, you know, I think this pandemic is going to change theater going forward on some level. I don't know. I can't say if it's going to be for the best or not. But I mean, I personally do miss the experience of being in a room full of people, which is also the reason, you know, maybe the reason that theater will be the last thing to come back. I think theaters had to sort of like do a self-evaluation about what their purpose is. And so I think something like this is kind of really exciting.
John Shepherd is the director of 10 for 21 for the Quantum Theater. He spoke with the Confluence's Mary Lee Williams. Here's a sample of a song from that production.
Oh, love, I've come to a place now I couldn't imagine, I cannot describe.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.